this misunderstanding that movies, this entertainment industry, has done
romantic
to us.
Comedies.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Although he's imperfect, we can totally ignore everything that is, of course, totally not true. And how, you know, sometimes we see around ourselves how culture.
Oh, you mentioned
gives
something
us
very good. Let me clarify the ground. So, just as we were talking about compromise, that didn't mean that you have to forget about all the bad things.
Yes.
No, some badnesses are just red flags.
Yeah.
You cannot continue with them.
Very
like,
red
for
lines.
Example, someone really used to lying. Mm-hmm. This is very sad.
Okay, yeah, that's a red flag.
Very much of a red
very
flag.
Very one.
Like, the border lines are like these clear-cut sort of statements.
Yes.
We cannot cross those borders. We're talking about human kind of badness. Like, the thing that might rise up once in a blue moon or, I don't know, maybe every day. But it's a very slight sort of badness that you can forget about it.
I want to simplify everything with the concept of friendship because most of the people have friends, you know.
Yeah. And you can do it with siblings as well.
Yeah, no, I'm good with friends because that is more interesting to some people and myself too. So this friend of mine that I'm talking about, she cannot express her emotions through words. I would literally text her, girl, I miss you, and
yeah,
she would leave me on scene.
Yeah.
Girl, just leave a heart. No, she wouldn't. So at first it used to annoy me, but now that I know that, now I'm sure that she feels the same towards
yeah
me, and I know that she cannot express her emotions through words, I have accepted. So this one is not a red line for me.
Yeah.
But if one day she starts talking bad about me behind me, then yes, that is a red line.
You see, now talking behind or back is that's a different story, and don't open that door. Because even with siblings, when it happens, it's like a real fight.
Yes.
A real fight. So, speaking of friends, I have some problems with one of my friends that is one of my close friends. And the problem is that she's too flexible. She's too flexible with everything. And she's so prone into all the new things. Like, everything seems like an adventure to her.
Okay.
And she can accept that full-heartedly. So this was one of our problems, but by time, as we start talking about it, now she's more aware of her personality.
Yes, we brought changes.
Yeah, at least we can, you know, add some touch of change into each other. Even that could apply to siblings. That could actually be applied to siblings, to friends, to whomever. By the way, we're talking about marriages, and the thing about marriages is that the same thing that happens in the friendship and the same thing that we would see among your siblings and your loved ones, the same thing would be applied to your love life. Like, do not expect a perfection in that house while you are already compromising with other imperfections in other places or elsewhere. So you have to be very aware of the fact and realize it, that us human beings have got good points. We have pros and cons.
Yes, so we choose what to compromise with and what we should not compromise. It is very important.
And the thing about marriage, I do believe, is that friendship that must exist between the couples. I do believe that, you know, in life, in modern life, there's poverty. There might be a phase of poverty, not in an extreme form, but, you know, everybody
to
could
some
go
level.
Through. Exactly.
Everyone
financial
knows
issues, let's put it this way. Because when you say poverty, it means like so penniless. But if financial issues is going to make it prettier, then all the couples, probably all of them, are going to get into that phase of suffering financially. The thing that makes you stay there is not the money, actually, is the friendship. Like, you accept it to be with each other in the hardships and at the time of ease. So you have to practice it. And, you know, sometimes these situations, these conditions that life is going to offer you with and it's going to actually offer that plate of hardship for you, be it financial issue, be it some sort of disease or perhaps some other very drastic changes that might happen to the life of couples, the thing that you can continue with, the thing that is going to be a sign of endurance and it's going to help you go on, the one and only thing is that love that exists in between you. The love that you have for each other, which is going to actually cover the fact that we have all these difficulties. Even though he's angry right now, I can understand that this situation is adding this much of burden to him. So I'm going to be kinder to him at times.
Yes.
When I'm angry, he has to do the same thing for me. And I have seen this in him. That's why I'm respecting him. You know, this is the life of couples.
And you know how traditions and society make us think about marriage? It's that a perfect marriage is when, you know, the man is earning very, very well and the woman cooks very well. Of course, not everywhere, but I have seen this. Yes, these cliches, how they distort how we think.
I think we're past that cliche of women cooking so well. Nowadays, men are good cooks as well.
Yes, but I'm sure many have not. And I'm very sure that we still might have some wrong beliefs that society has forced us to think.
Yeah.
And yet we think that this is our thought.
Mm-hmm.
I hope we will know it, that this is not the truth. And we need to, you know, take the right path.
Exactly.
Which God has given us. And it's very nice that our Islamic teachings do not tell us that he has to be very rich. Or she
No. The first thing that is prioritized, first of all, is his religiosity and his spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he's scared of God, then he would never do you any harm. Because it is the matter of humanity.
Yes. I was just going to mention that you stole my words. So the first thing that we need to, you know, take into consideration is that, is he a God-fearer?
Yeah. First thing first. Second, manners. This matters too much because I've seen many people, many couples who do not have anything materialistic in their life, but the only thing that is clinging them to each other is the respect they have towards each other. Is the, you know, there are these vivacious people that even in the hardships, they would offer you their smiles and they would offer you all the supports you need with the words. All these things are going to compensate and are going to just fill the gap that you're suffering from in your everyday life, be it a married life or a single life.
I would like to mention a verse from Holy Quran, you know, second surah, ayat number 187. It says that they are clothing for you and you are clothing for them. So this is symbolizing that they should be protection, comfort, and dignity for each other. This is that it shows the main goal of marriage is the peace that they provide for each
and
other.
And the friendship, you know, they inhabit each other's heart. So you become the house of each other. And this combination is going to create that bond, which actually makes you forget all the difficulties that life might offer you. So this was all for today's episode. By the way, if I want to sum it all up, I would put it this way, that a perfect marriage does not exist in the materialistic format, but in the spiritual way, as in your one and only is going to help you flourish more of yourself, is going to develop in a better version of yourself, and is going to be always there for you. Yes, it exists, but you have to work for it very hard. And it does not come with just one day or miracle. You have to know each other, and time has to be passed by. So this was all for today. I hope you have enjoyed it. Until another episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you dear youth will see that day and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This life as you know, you reap what you sow. And when you do good, Allah will protect you and stop you falling down. Allah, we surrender, 'cause he knows all, no compromise. Hears your laugh and feels your cry. He is there all the time. Make dua, praise Allah, our iman will grow.
today's episode, we will take a look at how Hebrew media covered the commemoration of the first anniversary of the assassination of His Eminence, the Supreme Martyr, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon. Other topics include U.S. President Donald Trump's plan to end the war on Gaza, as well as the international isolation of the occupation entity. We will discuss these and much more with Ms. Charlotte Skates, International Coordinator of Sabidut, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome.
Thank you.
The tweet written by His Eminence, the leader Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the anniversary of the assassination of the nation's martyr, His Eminence, the Supreme Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, was covered by Hebrew media, which highlighted the content of the tweet, warning that the occupation entity must think carefully about what is coming. Well, Charlotte, what exactly do you think is meant here by saying that Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's speech or tweet is a sign of what, or sign for what will happen later?
Well, the fact is, and this is something that the Zionists are having a very difficult time coming to terms with, is that they have been filling their media with propaganda for the past year, claiming that they have eliminated the capabilities of Hezbollah, claiming that they have achieved some kind of a victory in Lebanon. And the fact is that they have failed to do so. And every time that they are forced to confront the massive popular regard and support for Sayyid Nasrallah, the fact that he is a martyr of the entire nation, the fact that the capabilities of Hezbollah remain intact, that the popular support of Hezbollah remains intact, and relying on and wishing the Lebanese government to be some sort of proxy for the Zionist regime, totally against the interests and the wishes of the people of Lebanon, is absolutely a failing strategy. And so it's not just a question of not being strong enough. The fact is that it's in the interests of Lebanon to defend itself against the ongoing series of Zionist assassinations and attacks being carried out on a daily basis. And their attempts to incite civil war in Lebanon are failing. And the reality is that what is standing out 1 year later is the fact that Sayyid Nasrallah remains an icon of resistance, of steadfastness, and that when thousands, tens of thousands of people joined the ceremony to honor Sayyid Nasrallah on Saturday, on the one-year anniversary of his martyrdom, of his assassination, they pledged to remain on the path. And so it's not just a memory of a leader who's been taken away, but a commitment to continue the struggle, and that they have not been able to achieve that despite all of their terror, all of their destruction, all of their threats, and all of their attempts to import civil strife into Lebanon itself.
How did this commemoration ceremony, as you've been highlighting, because not only the Hebrew media has been covering Sayyid Ali Khamenei's speech or tweets, but also the commemoration ceremony of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. At times, they were convincing their own people that they have undermined and weakened Hezbollah. And then this mass crowd was seen by world media. What does that mean to Israel?
Well, it certainly means that everything that they've been trying to sell for the past year as the truth is not the truth. That Sayyid Khamenei's words about that the legacy of Sayyid Nasrallah still remains is absolutely correct and present. I mean, this, we saw the same thing at the massive funeral for Sayyid Nasrallah and Sayyid Hashem Safiyuddin in February, when like over 1.5 million people filled the streets surrounding Beirut.
Delegations from outside
with
Lebanon.
People flocking from around the world to participate. That the fact is that Sayyid Nasrallah is a symbol for Lebanon, for the entire region, of honor, of respect, of resistance, of steadfastness, where the Zionist regime, and particularly its leader currently, Netanyahu, is a reviled symbol of destruction and hatred.
Okay. His evidence, the supreme martyr, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, was a pivotal regional figure whose influence extended way beyond Lebanon in the axis of the resistance. This, according to some Israeli experts. By highlighting Sayyid Nasrallah's regional role, as the commentator was actually speaking about, is the aim here to show how big of an achievement was for Israel to actually assassinate this regional power, regional leader?
Well, it is, I think, one of the things that she's trying to convey, and that the Zionist media is trying to convey here, that, you know, they did, that they they struck a blow that was insurmountable to the entire forces of resistance in the region. But at the same time, I mean, what she's also admitting is that Syed Nasrallah was not an individual. I mean, he was an individual and a charismatic figure and a great leader and a great thinker and an inspiration to millions, but he was a builder and an organizer and a strategist. And so, and a strategist who was always aware of the kind of enemy that he was facing and that the movement that he's leading is facing, which means a movement that is capable of living beyond his martyrdom and fulfilling the goals for which he struggled. And so when she's referring to the building of institutions, the building of an alliance that stretches beyond borders, these are things that actually speak to the living legacy of Syed Nasrallah rather than the accomplishment or the technological or intelligence accomplishment in carrying out an assassination with 82 tons of US-made weaponry being dropped.
So will Hezbollah remain strategic, as you've been highlighting, even after the assassination of Sayyid Hassan?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I mean, it is clear that Hezbollah is a deeply rooted and organized movement that is, you know, not just made up simply of its the frontline military, but of an entire social system that is supported by the party and that also nourishes the party, and the spirit of resistance and the commitment to ideals and the faith and belief in the cause for which Hezbollah is struggling. And so that's something that cannot be eliminated by the martyrdom of even the greatest leader. It's instead something that speaks to the work and the achievements of that martyr and his fellow martyrs in the struggle of building that resilient structure that is capable of continuing and is capable of continuing and achieving new strategic goals. And that is something that the Zionists are having to come to terms with.
Fail to understand?
They've certainly failed to understand it because they continue this strategy of focusing on assassinations. But then they have to come to terms with the fact that they have not defeated Palestine, they've not defeated Lebanon, they've not defeated the resistance anywhere.
Okay. Expectations about U.S. President Donald Trump's announcement of a new plan to end the war on Gaza were closely followed by Hebrew media, which revealed some of its provisions and asked how Trump would push Hamas and the occupation entity to agree to it. Do you think Trump's plan that's being promoted, and some of the Hebrew media even revealed part of it, is actually feasible, especially that it's talking about removing Hamas from governance and also administration in Gaza?
Well, one of the things is that the Palestinian resistance, and Hamas in particular, has always been very clear that they're not carrying out the struggle in order to hold on to governance and administration, and that they're more than happy to support any legitimate Palestinian administration, but they're not willing to submit to foreign domination, Zionist occupation, and any of these other mechanisms which the Zionists are constantly trying to demand. Now, we have seen time and time again the U.S. claim to be pursuing a peace plan. Yes. Time and time again, they have claimed that the Zionist regime has already approved it. And time and time again, the Palestinian resistance has accepted it. Now, we've also seen repeated reports of potential rifts between Trump and Netanyahu being exploited in an attempt to deceive the people of the region and the resistance forces. I mean, most recently, we saw a so-called ceasefire proposal being sent to Doha, which was followed up at the same time with the attempt to assassinate the leadership of Hamas. So nobody should trust anything that Trump says about a so-called peace plan, because the reality is that every single day Trump and his government are supplying the Zionist regime with billions of dollars in weaponry to carry out the ongoing genocide that's taking place and that's being carried out by the Zionists. So there is no rift there. There is one front of aggression.
So it's another active action of deceiveness?
Well, we don't know exactly what this is, but one thing we can certainly say is that time and time again, these various proposals, despite the fact that the resistance has to give up its own interests in order to protect the Palestinian people and in order to end the genocide, they have dealt flexibly with every single proposal that has come through.
Yes.
And time and time again, what we have seen is the Zionists rejecting the proposals and then the U.S. saying that, oh, we blame the Palestinian resistance for this. And so we shouldn't expect something new.
After Microsoft announced its ban on the occupation army's use of the company's services for spying on Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, following protests by employees, Hebrew media confirmed that this step caused significant harm to the Israeli entity and impacted the espionage operation carried out by the occupation army.
How much impact does Microsoft's decision to ban the occupation from using its services to spy on Palestinians, or Palestinian phones specifically, in Gaza and the occupied West Bank?
Well, it's an interesting question because there are two things that are very clear here. One is that these big tech corporations like Microsoft, especially in the current environment in which the Zionist regime is becoming increasingly internationally isolated, in which there are more legal cases being pursued against the occupation regime and those who are complicit with it in genocide, Microsoft has every reason to fear being held accountable in courts around the world for its ongoing participation and complicity in genocide. And so this is going to give any responsible legal department in a corporation a lot of reasons to rethink continuing to provide these ongoing tech services to facilitate genocide, assassinations, ethnic cleansing, and the ongoing destruction of the Palestinian people in Gaza, in the West Bank, and throughout occupied Palestine. In addition, this also speaks to the power of worker protests and worker organizing for Palestine, because what we're increasingly seeing, whether it's dock workers in Italy, and in fact workers throughout Italy carrying out a general strike in order to demand an end to complicity in the genocide, dock workers in Athens refusing to load cargo that will ship weaponry to the Zionist regime to carry out the genocide, or what we've seen, which is an ongoing kind of uprising by tech workers in which people who have studied extensively to obtain jobs which are very influential and very highly sought after, such as AI developers at Microsoft, programmers at Microsoft.
The reporter also spoke about Amazon and Google. Do you think they're going to follow the path also of Microsoft?
I think there's certainly a possibility because just like at Microsoft, workers are organizing there as well.
Okay. Israeli social media platforms reacted to the sanctions that Europe has begun imposing on the Israeli entity because of the ongoing war on Gaza and the annexation projects in the occupied West Bank. Here are some of the comments.
Yaram Derota, Netanyahu's speech missed an opportunity to awaken Europe. He had a chance to change Europe's position on Israel, but he did not take it. Barak Sari, what will remain for us the next days? The fierce boycott against us is expanding in Europe and the world. More than 80% of the countries of the world have recognized the Palestinian state. Orly Reismon, Netanyahu ignores the European sanctions and insists on continuing his war on Gaza.
Why do some Israelis appear so concerned about the European stances?
Well, I mean, in the first place, Europe was the birthplace of Zionism. The Zionist project emanated from Europe. Certainly its leading sponsor now is the United States, but it comes out of European colonialism. And, I mean, the Zionist entity identifies as part of Europe. It wants to participate as a European country in sports competitions. It wants to participate in the Eurovision Song Contest. And so this is a rejection by the environment that created it. It's also, and the fact is that most European governments, with potentially the exception of Spain to some extent, have not really been living up to their responsibilities. While they have certainly talked about recognizing the state of Palestine, other than, of course, like the arms embargo from Spain, by and large, they are not putting an arms embargo on shipments of weapons. However, what there is a massive popular rejection of any continuing involvement with the Zionist entity throughout Europe. And European governments are having to deal with that reality, that their citizens do not want anything to do with continuing to fund and arm Zionism. And so, you know, the reality is that the Zionist regime is being left behind by the European milieu. It's being rejected because of the fact that it has become really a global symbol for nothing but genocide and destruction.
And that scares the Israelis.
It scares the Israelis because they have always relied on the U.S. and Europe, the entire imperialist sector, mm-hmm. is kind of enforcing the Zionist project in Palestine, and they're beginning to think that, you know, we're potentially on the road to there not being a future for the Zionist project in Palestine if its own backers and funders and founders are beginning to back away from it and are beginning to actually take a stand, challenging it in some way, even if simply for public relations in the face of massive popular upsurges of discontent.
Okay. Moving to the Yemen front, supporting Gaza, where Israeli military experts observe the Yemenis developing drones that now strike their targets directly, as happened with the drone that hit Eilat and caused dozens of injuries among the Zionists. How important is it that Yemen appears to be actually improving its military capabilities despite the continuous Israeli strikes?
It's very important, because what this shows is that despite the fact that the Zionists continue to attempt to bomb and destroy Yemen, attacking civilian targets, killing 11 leaders of the government, yes. in Sana'a, that the fact is that rather than quelling or forcing Yemen to step aside from the phenomenal role it has been playing in shutting down the supply lines of genocide and causing significant damage to the Zionist economy, that they've utterly failed to do so. And in fact, the Yemeni people, their armed forces, their leadership, the Ansarullah movement, are fully committed to not just continuing this front of support for Gaza, but intensifying it, expanding it, improving it, in order to struggle for the liberation of Palestine, which Yemen clearly sees as fundamental to achieving its own mission.
How do you see the future, then, of the Yemeni-Israeli front?
Well, something we have seen...
If the Yemenis are developing all the military capabilities...
Well, something that we've seen over the past 2 years, really, is that Yemen, despite years of being under siege, of facing tremendous, tremendous hardship imposed upon it, a war that was imposed upon it, of being divided, Yemen has become, today, a rising regional power. That it is impossible to think about the situation in the entire region without thinking about Yemen. And this is something that must scare the Zionist regime deeply, because rather than quelling the entire region and forcing it into normalization, what we've actually seen is the rise of a new Arab power that is committed to playing its role internationally.
So what's basically going to happen? More escalations between the two sides?
It's very clear that...
Especially that the Americans are not helping the Israelis here.
Yes, the U.S. already backed yes. out of its involvement. The European powers also backed out of their prior attempts to become involved in a military confrontation with
Yemen. And the Saudis
won't
be supporting
Yemen.
The Israelis too, especially after the attack on Qatar.
Yes, it's they're really... they do not have many forces that are willing to do their bidding in carrying out this attack on Yemen, and Yemen is committed to staying on the path. I mean, the only thing that is keeping Yemen from even doing more is the fact of its distance in terms of geography, and what it's doing through its missile development, its drone development, is working to shut down that spatial differentiation,
yes.
that geographical differentiation.
Our time is up. Ms. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator of Samidun Palestinian Network, thank you very much for joining us in this episode.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite back to reality. Yes, once more we are here to bring you back to another reality, which is the concern of today's world, I guess. And it's very prevailing everywhere. And I hope wherever you are, you're doing well and everything is just going so fine with you. So welcome to this episode. This is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be with you. And with me, I have two very dear guests, Brother Liaqat and Brother Muhammad. Welcome both of you to the studio and assalamu alaikum.
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum.
So, well, I know you already know how the ritual of this program goes. I would like you to give us a very brief introduction about yourself and about your background. What have you been doing all these years? So, let's start with Brother Liaqat.
Muhammad Liaqat Abbas from India. And I've done my bachelor's in history of Islam. And right now I'm doing my master's in psychology.
Very good. And you?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Muhammad. And I have studied a lot about the Quran and Islamic studies. While my university degrees are not related to this, I have a bachelor's in English literature and also English language teaching, master's in English language teaching. But I'm mostly interested in topics related to the Quran, especially, and also a hadith and anything Islamic. And I've done a lot of research in this field.
So I guess we have a perfect combination in here, psychology and Islamic research, which is going to help us too much to bring things into reality and into the spotlight of reality. Well, I always think that people changing is a myth, a huge myth, which is mostly unbelievable, unless something miraculous happens to them or revolutionary, something that would change their perspective, the way they look at the world and the way they define things in their everyday life. So when it comes to the topic of people, whether time is going to change people or not, I usually ask myself that, have you changed over the course of time? Not you as in person, as in one person, no. The way you look at the world and the way you have defined everything, the way you feel you have this school of thought for yourself. Do you think it is possible for people to change over time?
It is possible. When you speak about personality, because my stream itself is psychology of personality,
yeah.
Okay. Normally people don't change. Like they have something like stable, a stable
yes.
personality in themselves. And what changes is actually the behavior. What changes, actually?
You know, I also happen to have some psychological studies because of my thesis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I also know that all these psychoanalysts do believe that if a person is about to change, there is a key point, and that is very crucial, and that's a want.
Mm-hmm.
But we usually do not have that want to change, that urge to change. It doesn't happen.
Definitely. You know, if I go back to the studies of psychology, or let me go towards history now, because I've already spoken a bit about psychology. If you see in the history of Islam, there were a very, I would say, very little or very less cases where people have really changed. Example,
mm-hmm.
I would take the example of Abu Sufyan. Okay, if you see, his personality was the kind of personality who would go against the Prophet. There was a time he was with the Prophet, but again, when the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, he was martyred, example, he passed away, he showed his true color. Example, there were people with Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, but later on, they have turned back against their heels. There were few true companions of Imam Ali. They have stayed with them. So again, the question rises, okay, what about the personality? What about their personality? Was it really those people who have done bay'ah, example, who have paid allegiance to Imam Ali al-Islam in the event of Ghadir, were they really truthful or no? Like, the personality was the same and their behavior got changed. Over here, we say their behavior got changed. The
mm-hmm.
personality remained the same. There's one point where the personality of a person completely changes. Example, Hur. Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, you are right. Like, there's some key point in their life which made the person change completely.
A moment of manifestation, perhaps. Something must change you.
I think for the case of Hur, he already had that
potential
foundation in him. He had that potential, like you said.
Exactly. Yeah.
There was something good in him.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't change. His personality did not change.
He just got back to the right track.
He made another choice.
He made another choice.
Again, this is the issue of free will that we always talk
about. But you know, with time, personality also changes sometimes. Example, I know a lot of examples, and in fact, it is my topic of interest, where people who were with the Prophet and who have brought Islam during the time of Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who have been with Imam Ali alayhi salam in the Battle of Siffin, in the Battle of Nahrawan, they have supported Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yeah.
But later on, they have drawn their swords against Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the very people.
We can either be good or bad, and we're not forced to be good or bad.
Personality never changes?
Personality does change, but in this case, it was not a change of personality, in my opinion.
Why is it not?
Personality has the capability of changing. It's very flexible, actually.
Yeah, but this is the matter of choice.
This was choice.
You know,
yeah.
Choices, behaviors, everything, like the person's beliefs, everything has a lot of impact on personality. Personality is a very complex issue. It's not
exactly
as simple as, okay, fine. Because my choice has changed, my personality has changed.
Yeah.
We can't say this, okay?
And there's no rule book for it.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We have to first define what personality actually means. Like, personality could mean like a person is really outgoing.
My
he's
traits.
He's quiet, or he likes to talk a lot. He's really introspective. This is personality, okay?
Mm-hmm.
A person could be a good person with such a personality or a bad person.
I do believe that changing people is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But then still in today's world, I see that there are many people who have the courage to change. I think the first thing for a change of choice or personality, whatever you call it, is the wish to think. You recognize there is something that needs to be fixed.
I think time changes people. We can't say people are always the same no matter what. And
yeah.
Time doesn't change. No, time does have an effect.
Change is
one
factor. Sometimes it's very, very tiny.
Okay, right now we're living in a very modern world and we have made a lot of technological progress. If we were to live 1,000 years ago, would we be the same people? Would we have the same patience as those people who lived thousands of years ago before
knowing
us?
This, having seen this modern age?
No, we wouldn't be this. Yes, having seen this modern age.
Of course not.
Of course not. So
yeah.
Time does change people. You don't even need to go that far back. Let's go 100 years ago, 200 years ago, before the age of the internet. How were people living at that time? They didn't have, like, I don't know, Instagram and all these social media.
Yeah.
Their lifestyle was a lot different. Their personality was different. Their choices were different. So time does change people, but should time change people? No. People should be who they are meant to be, like good people. Time should not affect them negatively.
Mm-hmm.
If it affects them positively, that's good.
And
but
logically, if we want to just justify this, it would be like this, that the more you get older, supposedly, you have to change your perspective and the way you look at world. And
that's the idea of progress and, you know, like being a better version of yourself. That's the idea, right?
Yeah.
Personal development.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about this, self-building, you know? So we have to get better and better, okay?
Yeah.
We have a narration by Imam Ali. I think it's in Ghurar al-Hikam, I'm not sure. He says that,
woe.
He said, woe to the person whose 2 days are alike.
Yeah.
So we should not even have like a routine life where we're doing the exact same things and doing the same activities every single day.
Because I had the same life like today. Like today's life is like yesterday, so I'm So the woe of Amir al-Mu'mineen be upon me. No, mm-hmm. It's not like this. If I am good, if I'm following the Islamic laws, I'm really, in reality, I am excelling. Near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, my status is elevated than yesterday. Because yesterday I have prayed, example, in my whole lifetime, I have prayed, example, 2000 Salat al-Zuhr, the prayer of Zuhr mm-hmm. and Asr. Today it's 2001, so this is an elevation itself. Today I'm good to my family members, okay? I have spoken to them kindly. This is that yesterday plus one
And you
again.
Must actually have the intention. Like sometimes you have a routine, but you have it. You have this intention of changing yourself. Like mm-hmm. you want to develop yourself into this
Definitely.
Better version of yourself.
Yeah, it's the spiritual growth that you should be having.
Yeah.
Like I might be praying every day and doing all my wajibat and what have you, but I'm not growing. I'm like at the same level every mm-hmm. single day. See, with every advancement in society, people, their knowledge and awareness of things increases. Like, imagine how much ignorance people had centuries ago when there was no internet, right? Like, right now, people know a lot of things thanks to the internet. So mm-hmm. it's not always a bad thing, the advancements that the human beings make.
But you know, like if you turn over the leaves of history, then you would see that in past, okay, you called them ignorant. Maybe they didn't know about what was going on. But right now, they know that something huge is happening, something very miserable is happening, yet they could not or they do not do anything for it.
Yeah.
So still we have
That's
the same issue.
Like we have the idea where a human being can become better than an angel or worse than animals. This is the thing. When a person knows that they have to be like in a specific way, right? So if they don't do that purposefully and grudgingly, then they're going to be a question on the day of judgment.
You know,
if a person knows that Islam is the truth and he's a non-Muslim and he does not accept Islam, he is to be blamed. Why? Because he sees the truth, but he does not acknowledge it. Okay, we human beings, we know what is right and wrong, right?
Yeah.
We have in Surah Al-Shams.
The lights are inside of us.
No. We have the verse.
قَدْ أَفْلَحَ مَنْ زَكَّاهَا.
No. وَنَفْسٍ وَمَا سَوَّاهَا. Right? It means that we ourselves, we can tell what is good and what is bad. At least, like, everyone knows that they're doing something that is good, right? If we do the good things that we know are good, we're going to, you know, be really good persons, really good people in the future.
Yeah.
But if we insist on doing bad things, then obviously we're not going to improve.
So
the idea is do whatever you know is good, and don't do whatever you know is bad.
So it goes back to knowledge at the end of the day.
Very much, I guess that was a good sum up of whatever we've been talking about and a good advice, of course, to change your perspective, perhaps. So, and everybody could be the addressee of this statement. We all need to every day ask ourselves, what needs to be changed in me? So thank you for staying with us. Like always, your loyalty is everything that matters to us. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Ya Allah, ya Rabb al-alamin, ya Rahman, ya Rahim, ya Rabbi, ladhi umma raizak. Ya Allah, ya Rabb al-alamin, ya Rahman, ya daylight again, once again.
city that Iranians refer to as half of the world. If you ever visit Iran, this is going to be your first stopover, where you will be spending at least a couple of days.
The famous Iranologist Arthur Pope spent years to complete his surveys, specifically studying Persian art, listing over 190 crafts only in Isfahan. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization has recently named Isfahan as a creative city in terms of crafts and folk art. It's no wonder Iranians call it half of the world.
Now, something that really impressed Arthur Pope when he was visiting Isfahan is Minakari, and we're going to find out more about it.
Minakari, or enamel work, is basically the art of ornamenting the surface of a metal by fusing brilliant colors over it. The paintings or patterns are traditional designs depending on the taste and preferences of the artist. Gold has been used traditionally, but these days silver and copper are more common. Minakari is all about precision, but the process is not too complicated. First, a metal object made of copper, silver, or brass is covered with a white glaze and heated at 750 degrees Celsius to create the base. Now here's where the craftsman's creativity comes in. When he's done, the enamel plates are sent back to the furnace.
Isfahan is nicknamed the Land of Turquoise Domes. However, after coming to this small shop in the middle of the traditional bazaar, I think that it should be nicknamed the Land of Turquoise Dishes.
For thousands of years, blue stones have been valued in Iran and used in various forms by Iranian artists, especially to decorate different objects. But today, it is turquoise inlaid dishes that are catching the eyes of tourists who are looking for something extraordinary to take home as a souvenir. As you walk through the long corridors of the traditional bazaar, the omnipresent sound of pecking on metal will without a doubt lead you to one of these small shops where you can find works of qalamzani, or Persian-style metal engraving, a unique art that Isfahan is famous for. Qalamzani is used to decorate copper plates, trays, vases, and of course silverware. The painstaking process of creating each and every piece involves craftsmanship, skill, talent, and patience. The craftsman uses numerous tools to emboss and engrave the most detailed and complex of designs. This may include plants and flowers and animals, and people hunting or playing a polo game, reminiscent of the polo matches that used to be played right here in Isfahan.
Give me camel bones, some wood, and metal stripes, and I give you the beautiful art of khatamkari.
Khatam is Iran's most exquisite wooden handicraft. It is actually the Persian version of marquetry, which includes micro inlays made of wood, metal, and bones. Each cubic centimeter of khatam is made up of nearly 250 different pieces. The quality of khatam is determined by the finesse and symmetry of the patterns, which is highly dependent on the skill and expertise of the craftsman. This art flourished in Isfahan and the Safavid era. Khatam was initially used to adorn mosques and holy places, doors and furniture, but today it is mostly applied on mirror frames, Quran boxes, vases, and even pens and pen boxes. Therefore, quite accessible to be considered as a fine piece of art to remember Iran by. Probably one of the most interesting objects that is usually decorated with khatamkari is qalamdan, which literally means pen box. I'm specifically emphasizing on it because these small wooden boxes were once commonly used by calligraphers, writers, and of course students before modern stationery was introduced. Basically, the pen box itself is considered a valuable heritage, closely linked to Iranian culture. There was a time when artisans specialized in making the perfect pen boxes. Today, with the same traditional design, it is still among the most sought-after items in the traditional bazaar. Abundant in the most amazing craftwork you could ever find, Isfahan's traditional bazaar introduces you to a new world. With over 18,000 craftsmen, the city produces 196 different kinds of handicraft. It seems that the saying, Isfahan is half of the world, is not so boastful after all, but rather quite a well-deserved description.
Well, obviously the time that we had in this report is not enough to tell you everything about a city that is nicknamed half of the world. But at least I found something that I'm taking back as a souvenir.
Gisumisha Ahmadi for Iran.
Good evening to all our listeners. This is Iran Radio. Very nice to have you with us. We'll start this hour's programs with our news bulletin that will be followed by today's special daily mix format program that deals with various Islamic and Iranian occasions. Our radio productions feature will be next. And our final program this hour is Leader's Speech, presenting an English translation of a selection of the statements and speeches of the Honorable Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. Stay with us for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi slams the European Troika for its push to reinstate the UN sanctions against Iran, despite constructive and balanced proposals he offered to the E3 during his trip to New York. Well, the Israeli military kills more Palestinians in Gaza as it presses ahead with its genocidal campaign in the blockaded Strip. And finally, the Colombian president says his U.S. counterpart should be jailed under the Rome Statute, criticizing Trump's complicity in the Gaza genocide. Hello and welcome, everyone. Your world news. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi slams the European Troika for its push to reinstate the UN sanctions against Iran, despite constructive and balanced proposals he offered to the E3 during his trip to New York.
In the past week, I came to New York with very fair, balanced, constructive proposals to make a deal in order to find a diplomatic solution for this problem. But that was also rejected by U.S. and E3, and they went for a snapback and, have made this problem even more complicated. They tried military option. It didn't resolve the question. Now they tried the snapback. Again, it will not resolve this question, only make it more complicated and more difficult to be resolved diplomatically.
Speaking with American news channel CNN, Araghchi doubled down on Tehran's position that it has never sought to develop nuclear weapons. He pointed to Iran's commitment to the 2015 nuclear deal, saying that the Islamic Republic has implemented a deal with goodwill. Araghchi also blamed Washington.